This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. New Zealand on Saturday marked the second anniversary of one of its most traumatic days when 51 worshipers were killed at two Christchurch mosques by a white supremacist gunman. Several hundred people gathered at the Christchurch arena for the remembrance service, which was also live streamed. A similar service planned for last year was canceled due to the coronavirus. In the March 15, 2019 attacks, Australian Brenton Tarrant killed 44 people at the Al-Noor Mosque during Friday prayers before driving to the Linwood Mosque, where he killed seven more. Last year, he pled guilty to 51 counts of murder, 40 counts of attempted murder, and one count of terrorism. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole. The city of Minneapolis, Minnesota in the U.S. agreed to pay $27 million to settle a civil lawsuit from George Floyd's family over the black man's death in police custody. Council members met privately to discuss the settlement, then returned to public session for a unanimous vote in support of the massive payout. Floyd family attorney Ben Crump called it the largest pretrial settlement ever for a civil rights claim and thanked city leaders for, quote, showing you care about George Floyd, end quote. Floyd was declared dead on May 25th, 2020, after Derek Chauvin, who was white, pressed his knee against his neck for about 9 minutes. Floyd's death sparked violent protests in the U.S. and beyond and led to reckonings on racial justice. And Australia on Saturday recorded its first local COVID-19 case in more than 2 weeks after a doctor tested positive for the coronavirus. This is VOA News. Former Bolivian President Jeanine Añez has been arrested for alleged involvement in a coup against longtime leftist leader Evo Morales in 2019, the socialist government said on Saturday. Morales resigned and fled Bolivia in 2019 amid fierce protests against his government and allegations of electoral fraud. Añez, a former senator, took over as interim president by default, but 11 months later, Morales' Socialist Party returned to power in elections. Those elections were last October. A government minister said the public prosecutor's office issued an arrest warrant for Añez due to the case of a coup in our country, a claim Morales, who was president for nearly 14 years, has long made against his conservative political opponent. Añez's response was that the political persecution has begun and that there was no coup, but a constitutional succession due to electoral fraud. In the U.S., more than 1,000 National Guard members will be leaving Washington over the weekend, but several thousand others will stay on for days or weeks in the ongoing mission to provide security for the U.S. Capitol that has drawn criticism from lawmakers and reluctance from the military. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin earlier this week approved the Capitol Police request to extend the deployment of nearly 2,300 Guard members for about two more months because possible threats of violence remain. The Palestinian Authority and the Arab League on Saturday condemned the Czech Republic's opening of a diplomatic office in Jerusalem, calling it a violation of international law. The Czech Republic opened a Jerusalem branch of its Israel embassy, which is located in Tel Aviv, on Thursday. The inauguration was attended by the Czech Prime Minister. The United States is resuming humanitarian assistance to Yemen's rebel-held north to counter a looming famine in the country. U.S. Yemen envoy Tim Linderking made that announcement. A Saudi-led coalition has been fighting since 2015 to dislodge Iran-allied Houthi rebels who've seized much of Yemen's north. The administration of former President Donald Trump cut much of its aid to Yemen last year, saying the Houthis were diverting humanitarian assistance to themselves. U.S. officials say they are resuming the aid with new measures and monitoring to try to make sure the relief gets to the civilians who actually need it. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome to the show. Here are the issues we will be covering. President Biden scores his first major legislative win as Congress passes a massive COVID relief bill with no support, though, from Republicans. We mark 1 year since the official start of the pandemic here in the U.S. We'll look back at what it was like in those early days, what we have been through this past year, and what we could be expecting in the coming months. Plus, the U.S. expands sanctions against the leader of the military coup in Myanmar as a deadly crackdown on protests continue in that country. And the U.S. Secretary of State warning more action could be coming. Richard, Kimberly, it's a pleasure to talk to both of you again. We really could use your analysis and wisdom tackling the big stories of the week. So I'm glad you're on the show. I want to start with the action taken by Congress passing a massive COVID relief bill. $1.9 trillion, that's the number to know. It's a very big number. In fact, this is the largest standalone stimulus package ever passed in American history, the largest. So Kimberly, what's in it?
There's another round of direct stimulus or relief payments that will go out to most Americans, about $1,400, that will immediately give people some cash in the bank or in their pockets, depending on how they interact with the financial system. There's also expansions to tax credits for low-wage workers as well as families with children, and some of that money will actually be potentially coming even earlier than tax season when it usually arrives. There's more money for small businesses, a small expansion of the Paycheck Protection Program, but also new programs to help some of the worst hit segments of the economy, like entertainment venues and restaurants. A lot of money is going to be going, I think something like $350 billion, going to state and local governments to shore up their own programs, money to help reopen schools. This really is going to spread in a lot of different ways throughout the economy.
And yet, Richard, no Republicans, zero, supported this bill. Why not? What are their arguments?
Well, their main point fundamentally is that it's not a rescue or a relief plan. It's fundamentally a long list of old-fashioned left-wing priorities, according to them. They see this as a way to use money for Democratic priorities while there's still money from other plans that were voted last year that should be first used. There's this new interest in bringing down the deficit and bringing down the debt that wasn't there during the previous years, but suddenly they come up with this idea. There's also the impression that since we're seeing, even if it's not yet totally clear, fewer cases, more vaccination, restrictions are lifted, business are reopening, there's the impression that it could also overstimulate the economy with a risk of inflation. So there's definitely a ideological attitude on the Republican side, no vote on the Senate side, no vote on the House side, but the president wants to go ahead anyway.
A lot of good points you mentioned there. One of them being that this could do, like you said, overstimulate the economy, that the economy doesn't need a bill this large, and it could spark inflation, which would have its own economic repercussions. Kimberly, is the White House addressing any of these concerns, or is this sort of sell it to the American public that everything in this bill is good?
The White House is addressing it. The Federal Reserve is addressing it. And their response is basically, it's not that big of a deal. They say that inflation concerns are overblown. And even if there is inflation, we've heard from the Federal Reserve, our central bank, that they still believe that they have enough tools in their toolkit to be able to put a stop to inflation if it starts to get too crazy. But the Biden administration has consistently said that they are willing to accept the risk of overstimulating the economy if it means getting more of this cash out the door. And, you know, as Richard was just saying, advancing some of these priorities that they might not be able to pass on their own. One of the things of having such a closely divided Congress with the slimmest of majorities for the Democrats is that it makes it very hard to pass traditional legislation. So there was a big push to get as much of these Democratic priorities, especially the expensive ones, into this one piece of legislation. And I think we're going to be seeing similar moves with some of the other legislation coming down the pipeline.
The White House seems to be embracing this criticism that it's a liberal wish list. Like, yeah, exactly right. We want to expand the social safety net for this country, and that's precisely what we're trying to do. At this point, the bill is popular, according to polls. But that could change depending on how it's sort of implemented. If there's any corruption or misspending, or Americans don't get the money quick enough, or a big issue, if schools don't open fast enough, that positive sentiment can also change, Richard. So we are seeing the White House continue to try to sell this. What steps are they taking around that?
Well, it's just the beginning, Shayna. So the president is going to give his first primetime speech on Thursday. And in there, he's going to go over the year we've gone through, where we're going to talk about it a little later. But with the pandemic, the sacrifices that were made, the people who were lost, he will also bring back, insist on what this American Rescue Plan will do to restart something that will look like a normal life. And then the traveling around the country. The White House has insisted on this starting on Tuesday in Pennsylvania. The president is going to sell his plan to the Americans. Joe Biden, when he was vice president of Barack Obama, the lesson is taken out of the way the Health Care Act, the Obamacare, was sold. It was not dynamic enough. Even also the rescue plans after the Great Recession, everything that the Obama administration did was too low key for him, and he doesn't want to make the same mistake this time. So we've been promised that not only the president, but the vice president, the first gentleman, the first lady, they will travel the country to tell the American how this is going to be helpful to them. And the fact that they also at the White House in Congress insist on the fact that it goes further than just checks being given all around the place, as Kimberly described so well, but it's fundamentally fighting poverty. Child poverty could be cut in half. And these are clear changes to the reality of Americans that could probably help stop people criticizing the details of this program. There was some fraud here or some excesses there. The fact that it will not only have an impact on Americans' health, but the American economy at large.
Right. And at the same time, Republicans will be selling or trying to sell to the American public why this is a disaster, that it's overly expensive, it's poorly targeted, it's bailing out blue states for mismanagement before the pandemic. So this is certainly going to be talking points that we're going to be hearing over and over from both sides. And speaking about both sides, I think both of you sort of mentioned that Biden and the Democrats really went at this alone. I mean, there was some attempt in the beginning, Kimberly, to bring Republicans on board, as we've been talking about, no Republican support for this. So what does that dynamic mean going forward for other pieces of legislation that Biden would like to pass?
I think it does a couple of things. First of all, it signals to Republicans that the Biden administration will go it alone. So if they want any part of some of these bigger legislative priorities, that they may have a stronger incentive to compromise. On the other hand, as we were just discussing, the power of rhetoric is very strong, especially leading up to the midterm elections. So a lot of Republicans may feel it's in their better interest just to say, no, we are going to continue to block all of these initiatives rather than get a compromise or some version of what we want. We feel it's better to just say no and stop them from advancing larger packages, because without any Republican support, the best they can do are these budget reconciliation bills. And those have a lot of restrictions I won't get into right now. But the point being is that saying no still limits the legislative agenda in some ways, but refusing to engage also means that what does get through will have very little Republican input moving forward.
Very good point. And yeah, I don't think we have enough time to do budget reconciliation and get in the weeds there, but that is the way this was passed, and that's why they were able to do it without Republican support. I just want to bring up a figure that I've been reading. This is now the sixth COVID relief package to pass in the past year. Between what Congress has approved and what the Fed has spent, it's more than $6 trillion that's been thrown at the struggling U.S. economy. That is more money than the cost of all of the post-9/11 wars combined on just one pandemic. I mean, Richard, when you hear that sort of how much money has been spent, I mean, it's pretty mind-boggling.
It is, and it's speechless. I mean, it's so interesting, Shannon, when you look at this, we just bring ourselves back before the Trump administration, when it seemed to be a real ideological divide between people favoring government investing in the economy and the other side more into controlling expenses, bringing down the deficits. Now it sounds on both sides, even if we're hearing more and more on the Republican side, the old conservative way of looking at managing public finances. But with the Trump administration, this idea of limiting expenses, no, the place of government in restarting, helping, organizing society is seen as far more fundamental and necessary than, I'm not talking about the 60s or the 50s now, just like 5 years ago. But I think the pandemic is this once in a century moment, event, reality that totally transform the way we want to organize the states. Trying to figure out how are we going to pay for this? You don't want to start thinking about this because it's almost unfathomable how you can organize society to end up paying for this. Thankfully, interest rates are so low that at the moment, it's probably the best time to borrow that amount of money.
Well said. Let's put this to rest, take a break. And when we come back, we'll cover immigration, 1 year since the pandemic began, and what's going on in Myanmar. We'll be right back.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace. Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to be talking about an immigration crisis at the border right now, although the White House doesn't want to use that word. There is an issue going on. In recent weeks, there's been a surge in the number of migrant children trying to get into the U.S. According to the New York Times, the number of migrant children held in federal custody has tripled in recent weeks. The number of migrants trying to get in general are at levels we haven't seen in years. Kimberly, Biden has promised a more humane approach to immigration than his predecessor, Donald Trump. But how difficult is that balancing act given the complicated reality at the border?
This has been the struggle of many administrations, and it's not going to get any easier just because there's a new president in the White House. I mean, very famously, Obama began a large numbers of deportations and was roundly criticized for that. Then when Trump was in office, there were also policies that did indeed prevent people from crossing the border, the Remain in Mexico plans and things like that. And so by ending some of those policies, it did do what some activists say is release pent-up demand. And so this flood that we're seeing are people who were heavily restricted either because of pandemic regulations or through Trump-era policies that the Biden administration believes were deeply problematic, are now able to begin moving through the system. And that does create this surge. Additionally, the coronavirus pandemic is, hesitate to say this, but with the vaccine rollout and lowering hospitalizations, there are lessening fears of people coming into the country. So there's a lot of factors at play. There is not enough infrastructure at the border to handle all of these people, and that infrastructure was underinvested during the Trump administration as a disincentive for people to cross the border. So all of these things coming together are exactly as you said. It makes it a very complicated situation with real human consequences.
You brought up a lot of good points. I mean, the Biden administration has been saying this is a mess they inherited, and Biden has been pleading with immigrants not to come now. But regardless of whose fault it is, at this point, it's Biden's responsibility what happens at the border. And Republicans are really hammering the administration over this, blaming them for overturning Trump's immigration policies. And that's what's causing the surge. Richard, do you see Republicans making this a central issue in their attacks on Biden? And is it a winning issue?
Yes, for making it a central issue against the Biden administration. Yes, a winning issue with their electorate. Donald Trump had a lot of success in 2016 hammering these xenophobic policies. I did not see in the last election, general election, presidential and congressional election, a change within the Republican electorate on this issue. I'm afraid at the moment that the president is paying the price of his campaign, during which he insisted, and surely correctly, that, his policy, his immigration policy, is going to be a more humane policy. Jen Psaki, his press secretary, repeats it almost every day. However, the message that was sent on the other side of the border is that, okay, now it's going to be easier to come in. Let's find a way to reach the border of the U.S. and Mexico. And so I'm afraid that even if on one side it was absolutely necessary to go back to something that looks more like American values, but the misery in Central America, the poverty, the violence, the reality of two hurricanes and the economic hardship that came out of there makes it so tempting to leave and to come north. At a certain point, not only technically, logistically, there won't be enough facilities and shelters for all these people, but just restarting this policy of, I'm using the expression of catch and release that is very often used. Unfortunately, I do believe it's going to be a winning argument for the Republicans during the midterms election.
You know, even though the White House is not calling this a crisis, clearly they do realize this is a big problem. You had White House officials down at the border visiting this week, and even if they're promising a more humane approach, when you've got that many kids being held in federal custody, unfortunately, a lot could go wrong. I want to move on to another big story this week. It's been a very important anniversary that a lot of Americans are marking. It's the one-year anniversary since this country started to go into the lockdown that we've been dealing with for the past year. Kim, I've been reading these recaps that news outlets have been putting out, sort of a day-by-day recap of this time last year. And as I'm reading it, as they're talking about how the country began shutting down, schools and businesses starting to close, my throat starts to close as well, because I know what's coming. It's not going to be a couple weeks. This is going to last a very long time. What are your thoughts when we look back at what happened this time last year?
I think back actually to February 26th. I know that March 11th was the day that the World Health Organization labeled this a pandemic. But on March 26th, there was a CDC doctor who gave a press conference and said that she sat down that morning at her breakfast table with her husband and her children and told them that their lives were about to change and that they needed to get ready and that it was going to upend everything. It was so prescient. And there were people who looked at what was going on back in March of last year, knew it was going to be bad, knew how bad it was going to be, knew what we could do to stop it. And one of the saddest things is that it didn't happen. I was on the show March of last year talking about some of those predictions and how bad it could be. And people knew what to do, but there was not the political will to do it. And so when I think about the more than 500,000 people that we've lost, and, you know, I was struck when we were talking earlier about the relief bill, how it's more money than we spent on all of these wars. We've lost more people than we lost in all of those wars. The unemployment situation is unprecedented since the Great Depression, and none of us will ever be the same. Our economy will not be the same. Our mental health situation in this country will never be the same when you think about the compounding effects of a year of grief and stress and parents working from home while trying to juggle the responsibilities of childcare and the fear, living under the cloud of fear for a year is something that I think will change all of us forever.
And as you point out, different than the wars, we also have, as a country, not been really able to mourn the loss as you would, for instance, those who die in war. You could go to funerals, you can gather with loved ones to grieve together. Just the country has not been able to grieve together. 500,000 people, it's more than that now, just a staggering number. And Richard, I mean, it's been a tough year for everyone. I don't think anyone has really gotten through this year unscathed. The loss of life, the loss of financial security, millions of people getting sick, some still having side effects from being sick. Of course, this is not unique to the United States. This is a global pandemic. How are other countries marking a year into the pandemic? Although I know for some countries, this began earlier than here in the United States.
I think just the way Kimberly and you, Shana, described the reality in the U.S., how shocking it is, you know, 528 million people that we've lost because of this. They look at their own reality. And the fact that here in the US, it's 10 million fewer jobs, jobs that have disappeared, people who are not working. And it's the same thing in those countries. I just want to underline this as for myself. Maybe I'm too much of an optimistic, but I'm looking at this. And just as you said, Shannon, you said it was tough for everyone. Well, the only good thing in this is that we were all in this together, the entire planet, we share that together. The sadness and the pain of having lost these people and our lives being transformed, we're starting more or less at the same point looking up at the moment.
And if I can continue the theme of seeing something good, there is some good news coming. I mean, the numbers of people being vaccinated in the US every day, the numbers are at record highs. I mean, I think we've seen 2 million people being given vaccines a day. Public health experts are predicting that by the summer or by the fall, we'll have herd immunity. Kimberly, from just a political point of view, Biden had originally promised that we wouldn't see shots for everyone until the summer. Now he's saying we're going to see that much earlier in May. Do you think that's a deliberate strategy by the Biden administration to sort of underpromise and then overdeliver?
I think the risk of him being wrong and not delivering are so high that the benefit is only to underpromise and overdeliver. I think he made that original announcement before the Johnson & Johnson vaccine had been cleared and before those orders had been secured. And then once that supply came online, it opened the floodgates, you know, in terms of how many people could get vaccinated. I do think it's worthwhile thinking about vaccines, though, from the global perspective, which is that it's really great that the United States is getting all of the supply and all these folks are going to be able to be vaccinated. It will be very interesting to see how the vaccines flow throughout the rest of the world, including some of the less developed nations that don't have the ability to buy the vaccines in the more competitive marketplace. And so the thing that will really control the pandemic and these new variants will be getting this vaccine spread globally and also back here in the United States, making sure that people actually want to take it because of a history of discrimination and bad relations with the medical establishment. A lot of the groups that are most vulnerable to the pandemic here in the U.S., talking about Black people and Hispanic and Latino people, are less likely to want to be vaccinated. And so there have been all of these big public service campaigns to try to convince people to be vaccinated, but that's going to be an ongoing challenge.
Yeah, the one the White House has been putting some effort into helping with that issue for sure. And then this idea of vaccine diplomacy, as you've been talking about, on a sort of getting vaccines to other countries and some countries taking advantage of the influence they'll have getting vaccines to other countries is something we're going to be watching as well. Just very quickly, we have a couple of minutes left. I want to touch on a global story that continues to get a lot of attention. The U.S. this week expanded sanctions on the leader of the violent military coup in the Southeast Asian country of Myanmar or Burma. It's a country that for a time seemed to be heading towards democracy, but the military last month overthrew the democratically elected government. There's been a deadly crackdown on protests. Dozens of people have been killed. The U.S. is wading in. They have, as I said, they've imposed sanctions and threatening more action. Richard, my question is, why is this country so important to the U.S.?
I think we know that Myanmar in the region has a lot of influence. Myanmar moving towards democracy was inspiring on that side. And I think that the Americans are adopting a certain number of decisions to punish the military and the commander-in-chief, Min Aung Hlaing, and the people around him. But I think they do hope to work, they expect to work at the UN Security Council, at the UN at large, with China to, you know, transform the reality over there. And the simple fact that the ambassador at the UN, the Chinese ambassador at the UN, has called for a de-escalation is a sign that the Americans are not only going to work on sanctions against the military rulers, but are back also in the international sphere to use their allies and their partners to put pressure on the leaders over there.
Yeah, it's such a complicated issue. I mean, it's a strategically important country because it borders with China. China doesn't want to see a democracy in their backyard, but China also has a really uneasy relationship with the Myanmar military. I mean, they both support the military, but they also support rebel groups that fight the military. This is definitely a complex story, lots of moving pieces, and really sort of plays out this competition between the U.S. and China. We certainly don't have enough time to go into it, but thank you for your analysis on that. And that is all the time we have. Thanks to Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Richard Lechendresse, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Shana Stulen. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and John Russell. Later, Alice Bryant explains the differences between then and than in this week's Ask a Teacher. We close with an American story. This week, it is part 4 of William Wilson by Edgar Allan Poe. But first,
the American Space Agency, NASA, recently landed its robotic explorer, Perseverance, on the surface of Mars. Now, scientists are using information gathered at a lake in southwest Turkey to help them search for signs of ancient life on the distant planet. NASA says the minerals and rock sediments at Lake Salda are the closest match on Earth to those around Jezero Crater on Mars. The spacecraft landed in Jezero Crater, and it is believed to have once been flooded with water. Information gathered from Lake Salda may help the scientists as they search for signs of ancient microorganisms in sediment around the crater. A team of American and Turkish scientists carried out research in 2019 around the edges of the lake. Scientists believe that the sediments around the lake came from large deposits formed with the help of microorganisms known as microbialites. The team supporting the Perseverance spacecraft wants to find out whether there are microbialites in Jezero Crater. They will compare the sediments from Lake Salda with carbonate minerals discovered on the edges of Jezero Crater. Carbonate minerals are made from carbon dioxide and water, two important elements of life. Thomas Zurbuchen is the associate administrator of NASA. He told Reuters, "When we find something at Perseverance, we can go back to look at Lake Salda to really look at both processes, looking at similarities, but equally importantly, differences that are really between Perseverance and Lake Salda." So we are really glad we have that lake, he added, just because I think it will be with us for a long time.
As she removes the fish from the oven, smells of garlic, pepper, and lemon fill the community kitchen. For Glenda Andrew, the smells bring back memories of family meals, community events, and religious get-togethers. They bring her back to the warmth of her native Caribbean in the middle of a cold, gray British winter that has seemed darker because of COVID-19. This is food for the soul, Andrew told the Associated Press. The 57-year-old adds that such food is needed now more than ever for Britain's older immigrants. Most of them have not been able to see their family and friends in many months because of the pandemic. Once a week, Andrew joins other volunteers to prepare hot meals with flavors of the islands. They bring the hot meals for free to people in an area called Preston, as well as surrounding communities in northwestern England. This area has recorded some of the highest numbers of coronavirus cases in Britain. The home-cooked meals are a reminder of home. One day a week for the last 42 weeks, the seniors on Andrew's list have enjoyed island specialties such as jerk pork, curry goat, and cow foot soup. The meal program grew out of her work with an organization called Preston Windrush Generation and Descendants. The group fights for the rights of early immigrants from the Caribbean and other former British colonies. In recent years, they found themselves threatened with deportation. The Windrush Generation is named after the ship that carried the first migrants from the Caribbean in 1948. It came to Britain following a government call for workers from throughout the empire to help rebuild the country after World War II. But in 2018, long-term legal residents lost jobs, homes, and the right to free medical care as part of a crackdown on illegal immigration. Many arrived to Britain from the Caribbean as children. They did not have paperwork proving their right to live in Britain. Some were detained. An unknown number were deported to countries they did not know or remember. When the coronavirus pandemic struck Britain, the free-spirited Andrew did not want the community to be victimized again. So she created the food program. Her food honors the tastes of the people she grew up with. She uses the best food she can find. "They're worth it," she said. "They brought us up. They've taught us so many things. They gave up their life in the Caribbean to come here." In addition to food, the volunteers offer a bit of human contact. The loneliness of the past year has been painful for many of the seniors. When the hot meals arrive, they get to talk with the volunteers and share stories. Celise Toussaint is 81 and came from the island nation of Dominica in 1960. He said talking with the volunteers helps him as much as the food does. He told the Associated Press, "They say hello and give you a meal, and maybe for just a few seconds, at least you see someone new, someone you haven't seen all week," Toussaint says, smiling at his wife. "If you are on your own, it is so nice to see a fresh face, especially bringing gifts." Britain's COVID-19 vaccination program may soon mean lockdown restrictions will be eased. But Andrew wants to keep making and sharing her island meals. I'm Ana Mateo.
Chloe Zhao is the first Asian woman to win a Golden Globe for Best Director. and also the second woman to ever win the award. But she is not finding universal praise in her birth country, China. The filmmaker of Nomadland finds that criticisms in China about her citizenship and identity are taking some of the attention away from the news of her success. The Chinese government has removed some social media posts about the film, which is now a leading Oscar candidate. These actions have raised questions about whether Nomadland will still be released in the country. Over the past week, Chinese web users questioned whether Zhao, who was educated in Britain and the United States, was still a Chinese citizen. They also asked if she could be counted as Chinese given comments she has made in the past. Even as some celebrated her win, others found two interviews in which Zhao said things they considered an insult to China. Now publicity about the film has been removed from social media in China. A post on the Weibo service from the government-backed National Arthouse Alliance of Cinemas no longer shows an advertisement for the film. At the heart of the issue are two statements, or quotes, from past interviews done by Zhao. Online users sent out images or screenshots from a 2013 interview with Filmmaker magazine. In the interview, Zhao said, "It goes back to when I was a teenager in China, being in a place where there are lies everywhere." The interview no longer shows the statement, but older versions of the website showed it. The second statement came from an interview Zhao did with an Australian website, news.com.au, in December last year. The news site reported she said, "The U.S. is now my country." But the news site changed the story on March 3rd to say they had not correctly reported Zhao's words. It published a note on the article saying it has been updated to reflect she said the U.S. is not her country. However, the older version of the story spread widely on internet sites in China. It is unclear whether the film will still be released in China. Chinese media reported it was expected to be released on April 23rd. The China Film Administration did not immediately answer Associated Press phone calls asking for a statement. Online debate has been split on the issue. Some people said Zhao had betrayed her country. They called her two-faced and said she left the country based on her father's wealth as the former head of a state-owned business. Others called for the debate to stay centered on her movie. A popular film critic, Chu Mufeng, praised Zhao and her film on his Weibo social media site, where he has 3 million followers. Chu noted that not only was she the first ethnically Chinese female director to win Best Director, she was also the first Asian woman. However, one of the top comments under his post said, "An American female film director, thanks, don't praise her too much." Chu answered the comment saying, "If an ethnically Chinese chef was great at cooking, would you ask him where he was from? Treat a good movie as if it's a feast. All you need to do is enjoy." I'm John Russell.
This week, we answer a question from our reader, Nyenye, who says, "Hi, I keep getting confused with the words then and than. I know that than is used in comparisons, but in some cases used as a conjunction. I'm confused." Hello, Nyenye. It is easy to confuse the words then and than. They look and sound very similar, and even some native English speakers find them troublesome. So here is the quickest way to remember. Then, spelled T-H-E-N, is used for time. Than, spelled T-H-A-N, is used in comparisons. Let's discuss each word in detail. We use then to make comparisons between two or more people or things. Listen to some examples.
She can run faster than the other girls.
I would rather order food than cook again.
The first example is a simple and clear comparison. The second may be a little less clear, but it does compare two choices, ordering food and cooking. What may cause some people trouble are expressions like no later than and no earlier than. These expressions involve time, but still use the word than. Here is an example.
I will be home no later than 5 o'clock.
It means the person will be back at 5 o'clock or sometime before 5 o'clock. Notice use of the comparative adjective later before the word than. Now let's discuss then. Then is used to talk about something as it relates to time. We use it to say what happened next or happens next. Listen to some examples.
Turn left after the bridge and then follow the signs.
We finished cleaning. Then we played a game.
We also use then in conditional sentences that have the form if then, like this.
If it rains, then we will go somewhere else.
Note that in if then sentences, the word then is not required. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Alice Bryant.
William Wilson, Part 4.
As I ended the last part of my story, I was speaking of that terrible evening when I played cards with a young gentleman called Glendinning. We were in the room of one of my friends at Oxford University. I had just realized that the young man, weak of mind and weakened by wine, had allowed me to win from him everything he owned. I was still trying to decide what I should do when, as I said, the wide, heavy doors of the room were suddenly opened, every light in the room went out. But I had seen that a stranger had entered. He was about my own height, and he was wearing a very fine, long coat. The darkness, however, was now complete, and we could only feel that he was standing among us. Then we heard him speak in a soft, low, never-to-be-forgotten voice, which I felt deep in my heart. He said, "Gentlemen, I am here only to do my duty. You cannot know the true character of the man who has tonight taken a large amount of money from Mr. Glendinning. Please have him take off his coat, and then look in it very carefully." While he was speaking, there was not another sound in the room. As he ended, he was gone. Shall I tell what I felt? Need I say that I was afraid, that I felt the sick fear of those who are judged forever wrong? Many hands held me, lights were brought, my friends looked in my coat. In it they found all the high cards, the valuable cards needed to win in the game we had been playing. Secretly using these cards, I could have taken the money of anyone who played the game with me. Mr. Preston, in whose room we were, then said, "Mr. Wilson, this is yours." He lifted from the floor a fine, warm coat and said, "We shall not look in this to prove again what we have proved already. We have seen enough. You will understand, I hope, the need for you to leave the university. At the very least, you must leave my room, and leave it now." Down in the dust though my spirit was, I might have tried to strike him for those words if, at that moment, I had not noticed something very surprising. My coat had cost more money than most men could spend, and it had been made especially for me. It was different, I thought, from every other coat in the world. When, therefore, Mr. Preston gave me the coat which he had picked up from the floor, I saw with terror that my own was already hanging on my arm, and that the two were alike in every way. I remembered that the strange being who had so mysteriously entered and left the room had had a coat. No one else in the room had been wearing one. I placed the coat offered by Mr. Preston over my own and left his room. The next morning I began a hurried journey away from Oxford University. I ran, but I could not escape. I went from city to city, and in each one Wilson appeared. Paris, Rome, Vienna, Berlin, Moscow. He followed me everywhere. Years passed. I went to the very ends of the earth. I ran in fear, as if running from a terrible sickness, and still he followed. Again and again I asked myself, who is he? Where did he come from? And what was his purpose? But no answer was found. And then I looked with greatest care at the methods of his watch over me. I learned little. It was noticeable, indeed, that when he appeared now, it was only to stop me in those actions from which evil might result. But what right did he have to try to control me? I also noticed that although he always wore clothes the same as mine, he no longer let me see his face. Did he think I would not know him? He destroyed my honor at Oxford. He stopped me in my plans for getting a high position in Rome, in my love in Naples, in what he called my desire for too much money in Egypt. Did he think I could fail to see that he was the William Wilson of my schoolboy days, the hated and feared William Wilson? But let me hurry to the last scene in my story. Until now I had not tried to strike back. He was honorable and wise. He could be everywhere, and he knew everything. I felt such wonder and fear of him that I believed myself to be weak and helpless. Though it made me angry, I had done as he desired. But now I wanted more and more to escape his control. As I began to grow stronger, it seemed to me that he began to grow weaker. I felt a burning hope. In my deepest thoughts, I decided that I was going to be free. It was at Rome during the Carnival of 1835 that I went to a dance in the great house of the Duke de Broglio. I had been drinking more wine than is usual, and the room seemed very crowded and hot. I became angry as I pushed through the people. I was looking, let me not say why, I was looking for the young, the laughing, the beautiful wife of old de Broglio. Suddenly I saw her. But as I was trying to get through the crowd to join her, I felt a hand placed upon my shoulder, and that ever-remembered quiet voice within my ear. In a wild anger, I took him in a stronghold. Wilson was dressed, as I had expected, like myself, in a rich coat of blue. Around his body was a band of red cloth from which hung a long, sharp sword. A mask of black cloth completely covered his face. "You again!" I cried, my anger growing hotter with each word. "Always you again! You shall not hunt me like this until I die! Come with me now, or I will kill you where you stand!" I pulled him after me into a small room nearby. I threw him against the wall and closed the door. I commanded him to take his sword in his hand. After a moment he took it and stood waiting, ready to fight. The fight was short indeed. I was wild with hate and anger. In my arm I felt the strength of 1,000 men. In a few moments I had forced him back against the wall, and he was in my power. Quickly, wildly, I put my sword's point again and again into his heart. At that moment, I heard that someone was trying to open the door. I hurried to close it firmly and then turned back to my dying enemy. But what human words can tell the surprise, the horror, which filled me at the scene I then saw? The moment in which I had turned to close the door had been long enough, it seemed, for a great change to come at the far end of the room. A large mirror, a looking-glass, or so it seemed to me, now stood where it had not been before. As I walked toward it in terror, I saw my own form, all spotted with blood, its face white, advancing to meet me with a weak and uncertain step. So it appeared, I say, but was not. It was my enemy. It was Wilson, who then stood before me in the pains of death. His mask and coat lay upon the floor. In his dress and in his face there was nothing which was not my own. It was Wilson, but now it was my own voice I heard, as he said, "I have lost, yet from now on you are also dead, dead to the world, dead to heaven, dead to hope. In me you lived, and in my death see by this face which is your own how wholly, how completely you have killed yourself."
And that's our program for today.
Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.